This is Audible.
Imagica. Written by Clive Barker. Narrated by Simon Vance. Book 1. The Fifth Dominion. Chapter 1. It was the pivotal teaching of Pluthero Quexos, the most celebrated dramatist of the Second Dominion, that in any fiction, no matter how ambitious its scope or profound its theme, there was only ever room for three players. Between warring kings, a peacemaker. Between adoring spouses, a seducer or a child. Between twins, the spirit of the womb. Between lovers, death. Greater numbers might drift through the drama, of course, thousands in fact, but they could only ever be phantoms, agents, or, on rare occasions, reflections of the three real and self-willed beings who stood at the centre. And even this essential trio would not remain intact, or so he taught. It would steadily diminish as the story unfolded, three becoming two, two becoming one, until the stage was left deserted. Needless to say, this dogma did not go unchallenged. The writers of fables and comedies were particularly vociferous in their scorn, reminding the worthy Quexos that they invariably ended their own tales with a marriage and a feast. He was unrepentant. He dubbed them cheats and told them they were swindling their audiences out of what he called the last great procession. When, after the wedding songs had been sung and the dances danced, the characters took their melancholy way off into darkness, following each other into oblivion. It was a hard philosophy, but he claimed it was both immutable and universal, as true in the Fifth Dominion, called Earth, as it was in the Second, and more significantly, as certain in life as it was in art. Being a man of contained emotion, Charlie Estabrook had little patience with the theatre. It was, in his bluntly stated opinion, a waste of breath. Indulgence, flummery, lies. But had some student recited Quexos's first law of drama to him this cold November night, he would have nodded grimly and said, "All true, all true." It was his experience precisely. Just as Quexos's law required, his story had begun with a trio. Himself, John Fury Zacharias, and between them, Judith. That arrangement hadn't lasted very long. Within a few weeks of setting eyes on Judith, he had managed to supersede Zacharias in her affections, and the three had dwindled to a blissful two. He and Judith had married and lived happily for 5 years, until, for reasons he still didn't understand, their joy had foundered, and the two had become one. He was that one, of course, and the night found him sitting in the back of a purring car, being driven around the frosty streets of London in search of somebody to help him finish the story. Not, perhaps, in the fashion Quexos would have approved of. The stage would not be left entirely empty, but one which would salve Estabrook's hurt. He wasn't alone in his search. He had the company of one half-trusted soul tonight, his driver, guide, and procurer, the ambiguous Mr. Chant. But despite Chant's shows of empathy, he was still just another servant, content to attend upon his master as long as he was promptly paid. He didn't understand the profundity of Estabrook's pain. He was too chilly, too remote. Nor, for all the length of his family history, could Estabrook turn to his lineage for comfort. Although he could trace his ancestors back to the reign of James I, he had not been able to find a single man on that tree of immoralities, even to the bloodiest root, who had caused, either by his hand or hiring, what he, Estabrook, was out this midnight to contrive. The murder of his wife. When he thought of her, when didn't he? His mouth was dry and his palms were wet. He sighed, he shook. She was in his mind's eye now, like a fugitive from some more perfect place. Her skin was flawless and always cool, always pale. Her body was long, like her hair, like her fingers, like her laughter. And her eyes, oh, her eyes, had every season of leaf in them, the twin greens of spring and high summer, the golds of autumn, and, in her rages, black midwinter rot. He was, by contrast, a plain man, well scrubbed, but plain. It made his fortune selling baths, bidets, and toilets, which lent him little by way of mystique. So, when he'd first laid eyes on Judith, she'd been sitting behind a desk at his accountant's office, her beauty all the more luminous for its drab setting, his first thought was, I want this woman. His second, she won't want me. There was, however, an instinct in him when it came to Judith that he'd never experienced with any other woman. Quite simply, he felt she belonged to him, and that if he turned his wit to it, he could win her. His courtship had begun the day they'd met, with the first of many small tokens of affection delivered to her desk, but he soon learned that such bribes and blandishments would not help his case. She politely thanked him, but told him they weren't welcome. He dutifully ceased to send presents and, instead, began a systematic investigation of her circumstances. There was precious little to learn. She lived simply, her small circle vaguely bohemian. But among that circle he discovered a man whose claim upon her preceded his own, and to whom she was apparently devoted. That man was John Fury Zacharias, known universally as Gentle, and he had a reputation as a lover that would have driven Estabrook from the field, had that strange certainty not been upon him. He decided to be patient and await his moment. It would come. Meanwhile, he watched his beloved from afar, conspiring to encounter her accidentally now and again, and researching his antagonist's history. Again, there was little to learn. Zacharias was a minor painter when he wasn't living off his mistresses, and reputedly a dissolute. Of this, Estabrook had perfect proof when, by chance, he met the fellow. Gentle was as handsome as his legends suggested, but looked, Charlie thought, like a man just risen from a fever. There was something raw about him. His body sweated to its essence, his face betraying a hunger behind its symmetry that lent him a bedeviled look. Half a week after that encounter, Charlie had heard that his beloved had parted from the man with great grief and was in need of tender care. He'd been quick to supply it, and she'd come into the comfort of his devotion with an ease that suggested his dreams of possession had been well-founded. His memories of that triumph had, of course, been soured by her departure, and now it was he who wore the hungry, yearning look he'd first seen on Fury's face. It suited him less well than it had Zacharias. His was not a head made for haunting. At 56, he looked 60 or more, his features as solid as Gentle's were spare, as pragmatic as Gentle's were rarefied. His only concession to vanity was the delicately curled moustache beneath his patrician nose, which concealed an upper lip he thought dubiously ripe in his youth, leaving the lower to jut in lieu of a chin. Now, as he rode through the darkened streets, he caught sight of that face in the window and perused it ruefully. What a mockery he was! He blushed to think of how shamelessly he'd paraded himself when he'd had Judith on his arm, how he'd joked that she loved him for his cleanliness and for his taste in bidets. The same people who'd listened to those jokes were laughing in earnest now, were calling him ridiculous. It was unbearable. The only way he knew to heal the pain of his humiliation was to punish her for the crime of leaving him. He rubbed the heel of his hand against the window and peered out.
"Where are we?"
he asked Chant.
"South of the river, sir." "Yes, but where?"
"Streatham." Though he'd driven through this area many times, he had a warehouse in the neighbourhood, he recognised none of it. The city had never looked more foreign or more unlovely.
"What sex is London, do you suppose?"
he mused.
"I hadn't ever thought," Chant said. "It was a woman once.
Estabrook went on. One calls a city she, yes, but it doesn't seem very feminine any more. She'll be a lady again in spring, Chant replied. I don't think a few crocuses in Hyde Park are going to make much difference, Estabrook said. The charm's gone out of it, he sighed. How far now?
Maybe another mile.
You sure your man's going to be there?
Of course.
You've done this a lot, have you? Been a go-between, I mean? What did you call it? A facilitator?
Oh, yes, Chant said. It's in my blood.
That blood was not entirely English. Chant's skin and syntax carried traces of the immigrant. But Estabrook had grown to trust him a little, even so.
Aren't you curious about all of this? He asked the man.
It's not my business, sir. You're paying for the service, and I provide it. If you wanted to tell me your reasons,
as it happens, I don't.
I understand. So it would be useless for me to be curious, yes?
That was neat enough, Estabrook thought. Not to want what couldn't be had, no doubt took the sting from things. He might need to learn the trick of that before he got too much older, before he wanted time he couldn't have. Not that he demanded much in the way of satisfactions. He'd not been sexually insistent with Judith, for instance. Indeed, he'd taken as much pleasure in the simple sight of her as he'd taken in the act of love. The sight of her had pierced him, making her the enterer, had she but known it, and him the entered. Perhaps she had known, on reflection. Perhaps she'd fled from his passivity, from his ease beneath the spike of her beauty. If so, he would undo her revulsion with tonight's business. Here, in the hiring of the assassin, he would prove himself, and, dying, she would realize her error. The thought pleased him. He allowed himself a little smile, which vanished from his face when he felt the car slowing and glimpsed through the misted window the place the facilitator had brought him to. A wall of corrugated iron lay before them, its length daubed with graffiti. Beyond it, visible through gaps where the iron had been torn into ragged wings and beaten back, was a junkyard in which trailers were parked. This was apparently their destination.
"Are you out of your mind?" he said, leaning forward to take hold of Chant's shoulder. "We're not safe here."
"I promised you the best assassin in England, Mr. Estabrook, and he's here. Trust me, he's here."
Estabrook growled in fury and frustration. He'd expected a clandestine rendezvous, curtained windows, locked doors, not a gypsy encampment. This was altogether too public and too dangerous. Would it not be the perfect irony to be murdered in the middle of an assignation with an assassin? He leaned back against the creaking leather of his seat and said,
"You've let me down." "I promise you this man is a most extraordinary individual," Chant said. "Nobody in Europe comes remotely close. I've worked with him before."
"Would you care to name the victims?"
Chant looked around at his employer and, in faintly admonishing tones, said,
"I haven't presumed upon your privacy, Mr. Estabrook. Please don't presume upon mine."
Estabrook gave a chastened grunt.
"Would you prefer to go back to Chelsea?" Chant went on. "I can find somebody else for you. Not as good, perhaps, but in more congenial surroundings."
Chant's sarcasm wasn't lost on Estabrook, nor could he resist the recognition that this was not a game he should have entered if he'd hoped to stay lily white.
"No, no," he said, "we're here, and I may as well see him. What's his name?"
"I only know him as Pie," Chant said.
"Pie? Pie what?"
"Just Pie."
Chant got out of the car and opened Estabrook's door. Icy air swirled in, bearing a few flakes of sleet. Winter was eager this year. Pulling his coat collar up around his nape and plunging his hands into the minty depths of his pockets, Estabrook followed his guide through the nearest gap in the corrugated wall. The wind carried the tang of burning timber from an almost spent bonfire set among the trailers. That, and the smell of rancid fat. "Keep close," Chant advised. "Walk briskly, and don't show too much interest. These are very private people."
"What's your man doing here?" Esterbrook demanded to know. "Is he on the run?"
"You said you wanted somebody who couldn't be traced. Invisible was the word you used. Pies that man. He's on no files of any kind. Not the police, not the social security. He's not even registered as born."
"I find that unlikely."
"I specialize in the unlikely," Chant replied.
Until this exchange, the violent turn in Chant's eye had never unsettled Esterbrook. But it did now, preventing him as it did from meeting the other man's gaze directly. This tale he was telling was surely a lie. Who these days got to adulthood without appearing on a file somewhere? But the thought of meeting a man who even believed himself undocumented intrigued Esterbrook. He nodded Chant on, and together they headed over the ill-lit and squalid ground. There was debris, dumped on every side, the skeletal hulks of rusted vehicles, heaps of rotted household refuse, the stench of which the cold could not subdue, innumerable dead bonfires. The presence of trespassers had attracted some attention. A dog with more breeds in its blood than hairs on its back foamed and yapped at them from the limit of its rope. The curtains of several trailers were drawn back by shadowy witnesses. Two girls in early adolescence, both with hair so long and blonde they looked to have been baptized in gold, unlikely beauty in such a place, rose from beside the fire, one running as if to alert guards, the other watching the newcomers with a smile somewhere between the seraphic and the cretinous.
"Don't stare," Chant reminded him as he hurried on, but Esterbrook couldn't help himself.
An albino, with white dreadlocks, had appeared from one of the trailers with the blonde girl in tow. Seeing the strangers, he let out a shout and headed towards them. Two more doors now opened, and others emerged from their trailers, but Esterbrook had no chance to either see who they were or whether they were armed, because Chant again said, "Just walk, don't look. We're heading for the caravan with the sun painted on it. See it?"
"I see it."
There were 20 yards still to cover. Dreadlocks was delivering a stream of orders now, most of them incoherent, but surely intended to stop them in their tracks. Esterbrook glanced across at Chant, who had his gaze fixed on their destination and his teeth clenched. The sound of footsteps grew louder behind them. A blow on the head or a knife in the ribs couldn't be far off.
"We're not going to make it," Esterbrook said.
Within 10 yards of the trailer, the albino at their shoulders, the door ahead opened, and a woman in a dressing gown, with a baby in her arms, peered out. She was small and looked so frail it was a wonder she could hold the child, who began bawling as soon as the cold found it. The ache of its complaint drove their pursuers to action. Dreadlocks took hold of Esterbrook's shoulder and stopped him dead. Chant, wretched coward that he was, didn't slow his pace by a beat, but strode on towards the trailer as Esterbrook was swung around to face the albino. This was his perfect nightmare, to be facing scabby, pockmarked men like these, who had nothing to lose if they gutted him on the spot. While Dreadlocks held him hard, another man, gold incisors glinting, stepped in and pulled open Esterbrook's coat, then reached in to empty his pockets with the speed of an illusionist. This was not simply professionalism. They wanted their business done before they were stopped. As the pickpocket's hand pulled out his victim's wallet, a voice came from the trailer behind Esterbrook.
"Let the mister go. He's real."
Whatever the latter meant, the order was instantly obeyed. But by that time the thief had whipped Esterbrook's wallet into his own pocket and had stepped back, hands raised to show them empty. Nor, despite the fact that the speaker, presumably Pye, was extending his protection to his guest, did it seem circumspect to try and reclaim the wallet. Esterbrook retreated from the thieves, lighter in step and cash, but glad to be doing so at all. Turning, he saw Chant at the trailer door, which was open. The woman, the baby, and the speaker had already gone back inside.
"They didn't hurt you, did they?" Chant said.
Esterbrook glanced back over his shoulder at the thugs who had gone to the fire, presumably to divide the loot by its light.
"No,"
he said.
But you'd better go and check the car, or they'll have it stripped. First, I'd like to introduce you—"
"Just check the car," Estabrook said, taking some satisfaction in the thought of sending Chant back across the no-man's land between here and the perimeter. "I can introduce myself."
"As you like." Chant went off, and Estabrook climbed the steps into the trailer. A scent and a sound met him, both sweet. Oranges had been peeled, and their dew was in the air. So was a lullaby played on a guitar. The player, a black man, sat in the farthest corner, in a shadowy place beside a sleeping child. The babe lay to his other side, gurgling softly in a simple cot, its fat arms raised as if to pluck the music from the air with its tiny hands. The woman was at a table at the other end of the vehicle, tidying away the orange peel. The whole interior was marked by the same fastidiousness she was applying to this task, every surface neat and polished.
"You must be Pye," Estabrook said.
"Please close the door," the guitar player said. Estabrook did so. "And sit down. Tracer? Something for the gentleman? You must be cold." The china cup of brandy set before him was like nectar. He downed it in two throatfuls, and Teresa instantly replenished it. He drank again with the same speed, only to have his cup furnished with a further draught. By the time Pye had played both the children to sleep and rose to come and join his guest at the table, the liquor had brought a pleasant buzz to Estabrook's head. In his life, Estabrook had known only two other black men by name. One was the manager of a tiling manufacturer in Swindon, the other a colleague of his brother's, neither of them men he'd wished to know better. He was of an age and class that still swilled the dregs of colonialism at 2 in the morning, and the fact this man had black blood in him, and, he guessed, much else besides, counted as another mark against Chance judgment. And yet, perhaps it was the brandy. He found the fellow opposite him intriguing. Pye didn't have the face of an assassin. It wasn't dispassionate, but distressingly vulnerable. Even, though Estabrook would never have breathed this aloud, beautiful. Cheeks high, lips full, eyes heavily lidded. His hair, mingled black and blonde, fell in Italianate profusion, knotted ringlets to his shoulders. He looked older than Estabrook would have expected, given the age of his children, perhaps only 30, but wearied by some excess or other, the burnished sepia of his skin barely concealing a sickly iridescence, as though there were a mercurial taint in his cells. It made him difficult to fix, especially for eyes awash with brandy, the merest motion of his head breaking subtle waves against his bones, their spume draining back into his skin, trailing colours Estabrook had never seen in flesh before. Teresa left them to their business and retired to sit beside the cot, in part out of deference to the sleepers, and in part from his own unease at saying aloud what was on his mind. Estabrook spoke in whispers.
"Did Chant tell you why I'm here?"
"Of course," said Pye. "You want somebody murdered." He pulled a pack of cigarettes from the breast pocket of his denim shirt and offered one to Estabrook, who declined with a shake of his head. "That is why you're here, isn't it?"
"Yes," Estabrook replied. "Only
you're looking at me and thinking I'm not the one to do it," Pye prompted. He put a cigarette to his lips. "Be honest."
"You're not exactly as I imagined," Estabrook replied.
"So, this is good," Pye said, applying a light to the cigarette. "If I had been what you'd imagined, I'd look like an assassin, and you'd say I was too obvious."
"Maybe. If you don't want to hire me, that's fine. I'm sure John can find you somebody else. If you do want to hire me, then you'd better tell me what you need."
Estabrook watched the smoke drift up over the assassin's grey eyes, and before he could prevent himself, he was telling his story, the rules he'd drawn for this exchange forgotten. Instead of questioning the man closely, concealing his own biography so that the other would have as little hold on him as possible, he spilled the tragedy in every unflattering detail. Several times he almost stopped himself, but it felt so good to be unburdened that he let his tongue defy his better judgment. Not once did the other man interrupt the litany, and it was only when a rapping on the door announcing Chance's return interrupted the flow that Esterbrook remembered there was anyone else alive in the world tonight besides himself and his confessor. And by that time the tale was told. Pye opened the door but didn't let Chant in.
"We'll wander over to the car when we've finished," he told the driver. "We won't be long."
Then he closed the door again and returned to the table.
"Something more to drink?" he asked.
Esterbrook declined but accepted a cigarette as they talked on, Pye requesting details of Judith's whereabouts and movements, Esterbrook supplying the answers in a monotone. Finally, the issue of payment, £10,000, to be paid in two halves, the first upon agreement of the contract, the second after its completion.
"Chant has the money," Esterbrook said.
"Shall we walk, then?"
Pye said. Before they left the trailer, Esterbrook looked into the cart.
"You have beautiful children," he said when they were out in the cold.
"They're not mine," Pye replied. "Their father died a year ago this Christmas."
"Tragic,"
Esterbrook said.
"It was quick,"
Pye said, glancing across at Esterbrook and confirming in his glance the suspicion that he was the orphan maker.
"Are you quite certain you want this woman dead?"
Pye said.
"Doubt's bad in a business like this. If there's any part of you that hesitates..."
"There's none," Esterbrook said. "I came here to find a man to kill my wife. You're that man."
"You still love her, don't you?"
Pye said, once they were out and walking.
"Of course I love her," Esterbrook said. "That's why I want her dead."
"There's no resurrection, Mr. Esterbrook. Not for you, at least."
"It's not me who's dying," he said.
"I think it is," came the reply.
They were at the fire, now untended.
"A man kills the thing he loves, and he must die a little himself. That's plain, yes?"
"If I die, I die," was Esterbrook's response. "As long as she goes first, I'd like it done as quickly as possible."
"You said she's in New York. Do you want me to follow her there?"
"Are you familiar with the city?"
"Yes."
"Then do it there and do it soon. I'll have Chance supply extra funds to cover the flight. And that's that. We shan't see each other again."
Chant was waiting at the perimeter and fished the envelope containing the payment from his inside pocket. Pye accepted it without question or thanks, then shook Esterbrook's hand and left the trespassers to return to the safety of their car. As he settled into the comfort of the leather seat, Esterbrook realized the palm he'd pressed against Pye's was trembling. He knitted its fingers with those of his other hand, and there they remained, white-knuckled, for the length of the journey home.
Chapter 2. "Do this for the women of the world," read the note John Fury Zacharias held. "Slit your lying throat." Beside the note, lying on the bare boards, Vanessa and her cohorts — she had two brothers, it was probably they who'd come with her to empty the house — had left a neat pile of broken glass, in case he was sufficiently moved by her entreaty to end his life there and then. He stared at the note in something of a stupor, reading it over and over, looking, vainly, of course, for some small consolation in it. Beneath the tick and scrawl that made her name, the paper was lightly wrinkled. Had tears fallen there while she'd written her goodbye, he wondered? Small comfort if they had, and a smaller likelihood still. Vanessa was not one for crying. Nor could he imagine a woman with the least ambiguity of feeling so comprehensively stripping him of possessions. True, neither the Mews house nor any stick of furniture in it had been his by law, but they had chosen many of the items together. She relying upon his artist's eye, he upon her money to purchase whatever his gaze admired. Now it was all gone, to the last Persian rug and deco lamp, the home they'd made together and enjoyed for a year and 2 months was stripped bare. And so indeed was he, to the nerve, to the bone.
he had nothing. It wasn't calamitous. Vanessa hadn't been the first woman to indulge his taste in handmade shirts and silk waistcoats, nor would she be the last, but she was the first in recent memory, for gentle, the past had a way of evaporating after about 10 years, who had conspired to remove everything from him in the space of half a day. His error was plain enough. He'd woken that morning, lying beside Vanessa, with a hard-on she'd wanted him to pleasure her with, and had stupidly refused her, knowing he had a liaison with Martine that afternoon. How she'd discovered where he was unloading his balls was academic. She had, and that was that. He'd stepped out of the house at noon, believing the woman he'd left was devoted to him, and come home 5 hours later to find the house as it was now. He could be sentimental at the strangest times, as now, for instance, wandering through the empty rooms, collecting up the belongings she had felt obliged to leave for him, his address book, the clothes he'd bought with his own money as opposed to hers, his spare spectacles, his cigarettes. He hadn't loved Vanessa, but he had enjoyed the 14 months they'd spent together here. She'd left a few more pieces of trash on the dining room floor, reminders of that time, a cluster of keys they'd never found doors to fit, instruction documents for a blender he'd burned out making midnight margaritas, a plastic bottle of massage oil. All in all, a pitiful collection. But he wasn't so self-deceiving as to believe their relationship had been much more than a sum of those parts. The question was, now that it was over, where was he to go and what was he to do? Martine was a middle-aged, married woman, her husband a banker who spent 3 days of every week in Luxembourg, leaving her time to philander. She professed love for Gentle at intervals, but not with sufficient consistency to make him think he could prize her from her husband, even if he wanted to, which he was by no means certain he did. He'd known her 8 months, met her, in fact, at a dinner party hosted by Vanessa's elder brother, William, and they had only argued once. But it had been a telling exchange. She'd accused him of always looking at other women, looking, as though for the next conquest. Perhaps because he didn't care for her too much, he'd replied honestly and told her she was right. He was stupid for her sex, sickened in their absence, blissful in their company. Love's fool. She'd replied that while his obsession might be healthier than her husband's, which was money and its manipulation, his behaviour was still neurotic. Why this endless hunt? She'd asked him. He'd answered with some folderol about seeking the ideal woman, but he'd known the truth even as he was spinning her this tosh, and it was a bitter thing. Too bitter, in fact, to be put on his tongue. In essence, it came down to this. He felt meaningless, empty, almost invisible, unless one or more of her sex were doting on him. Yes, he knew his face was finely made, his forehead broad, his gaze haunting, his lips sculpted so that even a sneer looked fetching on them, but he needed a living mirror to tell him so. More, he lived in hope that one such mirror would find something behind his looks only another pair of eyes could see, some undiscovered self that would free him from being Gentle. As always when he felt deserted, he went to see Chester Kline, patron of the arts by diverse hands, a man who claimed to have been excised by fretful lawyers from more biographies than any other man since Byron. He lived in Notting Hill Gate, in a house he'd bought cheaply in the late 1950s, which he now seldom left, touched as he was by agoraphobia, or as he preferred it, a perfectly rational fear of anyone I can't blackmail. From this small dukedom he managed to prosper, employed as he was in a business which required a few choice contacts, a nose for the changing taste of his market, and an ability to conceal his pleasure at his achievements. In short, he dealt in fakes, and it was this latter quality he was most deficient in. There were those among his small circle of intimates who said it would be his undoing, but they or their predecessors had been prophesying the same for 3 decades, and Kline had out-prospered every one of them. The luminaries he'd entertained over the decades the defecting dancers and minor spies, the addicted debutantes, the rock stars with messianic leanings, the bishops who made idols of barrow boys, they'd all had their moments of glory, then fallen. But Klein went on to tell the tale. And when, on occasion, his name did creep into a scandal sheet or a confessional biography, he was invariably painted as the patron saint of lost souls. It wasn't only the knowledge that, being such a soul, Gentle would be welcomed at the Klein residence that took him there. He'd never known a time when Klein didn't need money for some gambit or other, and that meant he needed painters. There was more than comfort to be found in the house at Ladbroke Grove. There was employment. It had been 11 months since he'd seen or spoken to Chester, but he was greeted as effusively as ever and ushered in.
"Quickly, quickly," Klein said. "Gloriana's in heat again."
He managed to slam the door before the obese Gloriana, one of his 5 cats, escaped in search of a mate.
"Too slow, sweetie," he told her.
She yowled at him in complaint.
"I keep her fat, so she's slow," he said, "and I don't feel so piggy myself."
He patted a paunch that had swelled considerably since Gentle had last seen him, and was testing the seams of his shirt, which, like him, was florid and had seen better years. He still wore his hair in a ponytail, complete with ribbon, and wore an ankh on a chain around his neck, but beneath the veneer of a harmless flower child gone to seed he was as acquisitive as a bower bird. Even the vestibule in which they embraced was overflowing with collectibles. A wooden dog, plastic roses in psychedelic profusion, sugar skulls on plates.
"My God, you're cold," he said to Gentle, "and you look wretched. Who's been beating you about the head?"
"Nobody."
"You're bruised."
"I'm tired, that's all." Gentle took off his heavy coat and laid it on the chair by the door, knowing when he returned it would be warm and covered with cat hairs. Klein was already in the living room, pouring wine, always red.
"Don't mind the television," he said. "I never turn it off these days. The trick is not to turn up the sound. It's much more entertaining, mute."
This was a new habit, and a distracting one. Gentle accepted the wine and sat down in the corner of the ill-sprung couch, where it was easiest to ignore the demands of the screen. Even there he was tempted.
"So now, my bastard boy," Klein said, "to what disaster do I owe the honour?"
"It's not really a disaster. I've just had a bad time. I wanted some cheery company."
"Give them up, Gentle," Klein said.
"Give what up?"
"You know what? The fair sex. Give them up. I have. It's such a relief. All those desperate seductions, all that time wasted meditating on death to keep yourself from coming too soon. I tell you, it's like a burden gone from my shoulders."
"How old are you?"
"Age has got fuck all to do with it. I gave up women because they were breaking my heart."
"What heart's that?"
"I might ask you the same thing. Yes, you whine and you wring your hands, but then you go back and make the same mistakes. It's tedious. They're tedious."
"So save me."
"Oh, now here it comes.
I don't have any money."
"Neither do I."
"So we'll make some together. Then I won't have to be a kept man."
"I'm going back to live in the studio, Klein. I'll paint whatever you need."
"The bastard boy speaks.
I wish you wouldn't call me that."
"It's what you are. You haven't changed in 8 years. The world grows old, but the bastard boy keeps his perfection. Speaking of which..."
"Employ me."
"Don't interrupt me when I'm gossiping. Speaking of which, I saw Clem the Sunday before last. He asked after you. He's put on a lot of weight, and his love life's almost as disastrous as yours. Taylor's sick with the plague. I tell you, Gentle, celibacy's the thing."
"So employ me."
"It's not as easy as that. The market's soft at the moment. And, well, let me be brutal. I have a new wunderkind."
He got up.
"Let me show you."
He led Gentle through the house to the study.
"The fellow's 22, and I swear if he had an idea in his head, he'd be a great painter. But he's like you. He's got the talent, but nothing to say."
"Thanks," said Gentle sourly.
"You know it's true."
Klein switched on the light. There were 3 canvases, all unframed, in the room.
One, a nude woman after the style of Modigliani. Beside it, a small landscape after Corot. But the third and largest of the three was the coup. It was a pastoral scene, depicting classically garbed shepherds standing in awe before a tree in the trunk of which a human face was visible.
"Would you know it from a real poussin?"
"Is it still wet?" Gentle asked.
"Such a wit!"
Gentle went to give the painting a more intimate examination. This period was not one he was particularly expert in, but he knew enough to be impressed by the handiwork. The canvas was a close weave, the paint laid upon it in careful, regular strokes, the tones built up, it seemed, in glazes.
"Meticulous, eh?" said Klein.
"To the point of being mechanical."
"Now, now, no sour grapes.
I mean it. It's just too perfect for words. You put this in the market and the game's up. Now, the Modigliani's another matter."
"That was a technical exercise," Klein said. "I can't sell that. The man only painted a dozen pictures. It's the Poussin I'm betting on."
"Don't. You'll get stung. Mind if I get another drink?" Gentle headed back through the house to the lounge, Klein following, muttering to himself.
"You've got a good eye, Gentle," he said, "but you're unreliable. You'll find another woman and off you'll go."
"Not this time."
"And I wasn't kidding about the market. There's no room for bullshit."
"Did you ever have a problem with a piece I painted?" Klein mused on this.
"No,"
he admitted. "I've got a Gauguin in New York. Those Fuseli sketches I did.
Berlin. Oh, yes, you've made your little mark.
Nobody's ever going to know it, of course."
"They will. In 100 years' time, your Fusellis will look as old as they are, not as old as they should be. People will start to investigate, and you, my bastard boy, will be discovered. And so will Kenny Soames and Gideon, all my deceivers.
And you'll be vilified for bribing us, denying the 20th century all that originality."
"Originality, shit. It's an overrated commodity, you know that. You can be a visionary painting virgins."
"That's what I'll do, then. Virgins in any style. I'll be celibate, and I'll paint Madonnas all day, with child, without child, weeping, blissful. I'll work my balls off, Kleiny, which will be fine, because I won't need them."
"Forget the virgins. They're out of fashion."
"They're forgotten."
"Decadence is your strongest suit."
"Whatever you want, say the word.
But don't fuck with me. If I find a client and promise something to him, it's up to you to produce it."
"I'm going back to the studio tonight. I'm starting over. Just do one thing for me."
"What's that?"
"Burn the Poussin." He had visited the studio on and off through his time with Vanessa. He'd even met Martine there on two occasions when her husband had cancelled a Luxembourg trip and she'd been too heated to miss a liaison. But it was charmless and cheerless, and he'd returned happily to the house in Wimpole Mews. Now, however, he welcomed the studio's austerity. He turned on the little electric fire, made himself a cup of fake coffee with fake milk, and, under its influence, thought about deception. The last 6 years of his life, since Judith, in fact, had been a series of duplicities. This was not of itself disastrous. After tonight it would once more be his profession. But whereas painting had a tangible end result, too, if he included the recompense, pursuit and seduction always left him naked and empty-handed. An end to that, tonight. He made a vow, toasted in bad coffee, to the god of forgers, whoever he was, to become great. If duplicity was his genius, why waste it on deceiving husbands and mistresses? He should turn it to a profounder end, producing masterpieces in another man's name. Time would validate him the way Klein had said it would, uncover his many works, and show him at last as the visionary he was about to become. And if it didn't, if Klein was wrong and his handiwork remained undiscovered forever, then that was the truest vision of all. Invisible, he would be seen. Unknown, he'd be influential. It was enough to make him forget women entirely. At least for tonight. Chapter 3. At dusk, The clouds over Manhattan, which had threatened snow all day, cleared and revealed a pristine sky. Its colour so ambiguous it might have fueled a philosophical debate as to the nature of blue. Laden as she was with her day's purchases, Jude chose to walk back to Marlin's apartment at Park Avenue and 80th. Her arms ached, but it gave her time to turn over in her head the encounter which had marked the day and decide whether she wanted to share it with Marlin or not. Unfortunately, he had a lawyer's mind. At best, cool and analytical, at worst, reductionist. She knew herself well enough to know that if he challenged her account in the latter mode, she'd almost certainly lose her temper with him. And then the atmosphere between them, which had been, with the exception of his overtures, so easy and undemanding, would be spoiled. It was better to work out what she believed about the events of the previous 2 hours before she shared it with Marlin. Then he could dissect it at will. Already, after going over the encounter a few times, it was becoming, like the blue overhead, ambiguous. But she held on hard to the facts of the matter. She'd been in the menswear department of Bloomingdale's, looking for a sweater for Marlin. It was crowded, and there was nothing on display that she thought appropriate. She'd started to pick up the purchases at her feet when she'd caught sight of a face she knew, looking straight at her through the moving mesh of people. How long had she seen the face for? A second, two at most? Long enough for her heart to jump and her face to flush, long enough for her mouth to open and shape the word gentle. Then the traffic between them had thickened, and he'd disappeared. She'd fixed the place where he'd been, stooped to pick up her baggage, and gone after him, not doubting that it was he. The crowd slowed her progress, but she soon caught sight of him again, heading towards the door. This time she yelled his name, not giving a damn if she looked a fool, and dove after him. She was impressive in full flight, and the crowd yielded, so that by the time she reached the door he was only yards away. Third Avenue was as thronged as the store, but there he was, heading across the street. The lights changed as she got to the curb. She went after him anyway, daring the traffic. As she yelled again, he was buffeted by a shopper, on some business as urgent as hers, and he turned as he was struck, giving her a second glimpse of him. She might have laughed out loud at the absurdity of her error had it not disturbed her so. Either she was losing her mind, or she'd followed the wrong man. Either way, this black man, his ringleted hair gleaming on his shoulders, was not gentle. Momentarily undecided as to whether to go on looking or to give up the chase there and then, her eyes lingered on the stranger's face. And for a heartbeat or less, his features blurred, and in their flux, caught as if by the sun off a wing in the stratosphere, she saw gentle. His hair swept back from his high forehead, his grey eyes all yearning, his mouth, which she'd not known she missed till now, ready to break into a smile. It never came. The wing dipped. The stranger turned. Gentle was gone. She stood in the throng for several seconds while he disappeared downtown. Then, gathering herself together, she turned her back on the mystery and started home. It didn't leave her thoughts, of course. She was a woman who trusted her senses, and to discover them so deceptive distressed her. But more vexing still was why it should be that particular face of all those in her memory's catalogue she'd chosen to configure from that of a perfect stranger. Klein's bastard boy was out of her life, and she out of his. It was 6 years since she'd crossed the bridge from where they'd stood together, and the river that flowed between was a torrent. Her marriage to Estabrook had come and gone along that river, and a good deal of pain with it. Gentle was still on the other shore, part of her history, irretrievable. So why had she conjured him now? As she came within a block of Marlin's building, she remembered something she'd utterly put out of her head for that 6-year span. It had been a glimpse of Gentle, not so unlike the one she'd just had, that had propelled her into her near-suicidal affair with him. She'd met him at one of Klein's parties, a casual encounter, and had given him very little conscious thought subsequently. Then, 3 nights later, she'd been visited by an erotic dream that regularly haunted her. The scenario was always the same, She was lying naked on bare boards in an empty room, not bound, but somehow bounded, and a man whose face she could never see, his mouth so sweet it was like eating candy to kiss him, made violent love to her. Only this time, the fire that burned in the grate close by showed her the face of her dream lover, and it had been Gentle's face. The shock, after so many years of never knowing who the man was, woke her, but with such a sense of loss at this interrupted coitus, she couldn't sleep again for mourning it. The next day she discovered his whereabouts from Klein, who'd warned her in no uncertain manner that John Zacharias was bad news for tender hearts. She'd ignored the warning and gone to see him that very afternoon, in the studio off the Edgware Road. They scarcely left it for the next 2 weeks, their passion putting her dreams to shame. Only later, when she was in love with him and it was too late for common sense to qualify her feelings, did she learn more about him. He trailed a reputation for womanizing that, even if it was 90% invention, as she assumed, was still prodigious. If she mentioned his name in any circle, however jaded it was by gossip, there was always somebody who had some tidbit about him. He even went by a variety of names. Some referred to him as the Fury, some as Zack or Zacko or Mr. Z. Others called him Gentle, which was the name she knew him by, of course. Still others, John the Divine. Enough names for half a dozen lifetimes. She wasn't so blindly devoted to him that she didn't accept there was truth in these rumours, nor did he do much to temper them. He liked the air of legend that hung about his head. He claimed, for instance, not to know how old he was. Like herself, he had a very slippery grasp on the past, and he frankly admitted to being obsessed with her sex. Some of the talk she'd heard was of cradle-snatching, some of deathbed fucks. He played no favourites. So, here was her Gentle, a man known to the doormen of every exclusive club and hotel in the city, who, after 10 years of high living, had survived the ravages of every excess, who was still lucid, still handsome, still alive. And this same man, this Gentle, told her he was in love with her, and put the words together so perfectly she disregarded all she'd heard but those he spoke. She might have gone on listening forever, but for her rage, which was the legend she trailed, a volatile thing, apt to ferment in her without her even being aware of it. That had been the case with Gentle. After half a year of their affair, she'd begun to wonder, wallowing in his affection, how a man whose history had been one infidelity after another had mended his ways. Which thought led to the possibility that perhaps he hadn't. In fact, she had no reason to suspect him. His devotion bordered on the obsessive in some moods, as though he saw in her a woman she didn't even know herself, an ancient soulmate. She was, she began to think, unlike any other woman he'd ever met, the love that had changed his life. When they were so intimately joined, how would she not know if he was cheating on her? She'd have surely sensed the other woman, tasted her on his tongue, or smelled her on his skin, and if not there, then in the subtleties of their exchanges. But she'd underestimated him. When, by the sheerest fluke, she'd discovered he had not one other woman on the side, but two, it drove her to near insanity. She began by destroying the contents of the studio, slashing all his canvases, painted or not, then tracking the felon himself, and mounting an assault that literally brought him to his knees in fear for his balls. The rage burned a week, after which she fell totally silent for 3 days. A silence broken by a grief like nothing she'd ever experienced before. Had it not been for her chance meeting with Esterbrook, who saw through her tumbling, distracted manner to the woman she was, she might well have taken her own life. Thus the tale of Judith and Gentle. One death short of tragedy, and a marriage short of farce. She found Marlin already home, uncharacteristically agitated. "Where have you been?" he wanted to know. "It's 6:39. She instantly knew this was no time to be telling him what her trip to Bloomingdale's had cost her in peace of mind. Instead, she lied. "I couldn't get a cab. I had to walk." If that happens again, just call me. I'll have you picked up by one of our limos. I don't want you wandering the streets. It's not safe. Anyhow, we're late. We'll have to eat after the performance.
What performance?
The show in the village that Troy was yabbering about last night, remember? The Neo-Nativity? He said it was the best thing since Bethlehem.
It's sold out.
I have my connections, he gleamed.
We going tonight?
Not if you don't move your ass.
Marlin, sometimes you're sublime, she said,
dumping her purchases and racing to change. What about the rest of the time? He hollered after her. Sexy? Irresistible? Bettable? If indeed he'd secured the tickets as a way of bribing her between the sheets, he suffered for his lust. He concealed his boredom through the first act, but by intermission he was itching to be away to claim his prize. Do we really need to stay for the rest? He asked her as they sipped coffee in the tiny foyer. I mean, it's not like there's any mystery about it. The kid gets born, the kid grows up, the kid gets crucified.
I'm enjoying it.
But it doesn't make any sense, he complained, in deadly earnest. The show's eclecticism offended his rationalism deeply. Why were the angels playing jazz?
Who knows what angels do?
He shook his head. I don't know whether it's a comedy or a satire, or what the hell it is, he said. Do you know what it is?
I think it's very funny.
So you'd like to stay?
I'd like to stay.
The second half was even more of a grab bag than the first, the suspicion growing in Jude as she watched that the parody and pastiche was a smokescreen put up to cover the creator's embarrassment at their own sincerity. In the end, with Charlie Parker angels wailing on the stable roof and Santa crooning at the manger, the piece collapsed into high camp. But even that was oddly moving. The child was born. Light had come into the world again, even if it was to the accompaniment of tap-dancing elves. When they exited, there was sleet in the wind.
Cold, 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 Marlin said. I'd better take a leak.
He went back inside to join the line for the toilets, leaving Jude at the door watching the blobs of wet snow pass through the lamplight. The theatre was not large, and the bulk of the audience was out in a couple of minutes, umbrellas raised, heads dropped, darting off into the village to look for their cars, or a place where they could put some drink in their systems and play critic. The light above the front door was switched off, and a cleaner emerged from the theatre with a black plastic bag of rubbish and a broom, and began to brush the foyer, ignoring Jude, who was the last visible occupant, until he reached her. When he gave her a glance of such venom, she decided to put up her umbrella and stand on the darkened step. Marlin was taking his time, emptying his bladder. She only hoped he wasn't titivating himself, slicking his hair and freshening his breath in the hope of talking her into bed. The first she knew of the assault was a motion glimpsed from the corner of her eye, a blurred form approaching her at speed through the thickening sleet. Alarmed, she turned towards her attacker. She had time to recognize the face on Third Avenue, then the man was upon her. She opened her mouth to yell, turning to retreat into the theatre as she did so. The cleaner had gone. So had her shout, caught in her throat by the stranger's hands. They were expert. They hurt brutally, stopping every breath from being drawn. She panicked, flailed, toppled. He took her weight, controlling her motion. In desperation, she threw the umbrella into the foyer, hoping there was somebody out of sight in the box office who'd be alerted to her jeopardy. Then she was wrenched out of shadow into heavier shadow still, and realized it was almost too late already. She was becoming light-headed, her leaden limbs no longer hers. In the murk, her assassin's face was once more a blur, with two dark holes bored in it. She fell towards them, wishing she had the energy to turn her gaze away from this blankness. But as he moved closer to her, a little light caught his cheek, and she saw, or thought she saw, tears there, spilling from those dark eyes. Then the light went, not just from his cheek, but from the whole world, and as everything slipped away, she could only hold on to the thought that somehow her murderer knew who she was. Judith? Somebody was holding her. Somebody was shouting to her, not the assassin, but Marlin. She sagged in his arms, catching dizzied sight of the assailant running across the pavement with another man in pursuit,
Her eyes swung back to Marlin, who was asking her if she was all right, then back to the street as brakes shrieked and the failed assassin was struck squarely by a speeding car, which reeled around, wheels locked and sliding over the sleet-greased street, throwing the man's body off the hood and over a parked car. The pursuer threw himself aside as the vehicle mounted the pavement, slamming into a lamppost. Jude put her arm out for some support other than Marlin, her fingers finding the wall. Ignoring his advice that she stay still, she started to stumble towards the place where her assassin had fallen. The driver was being helped from his smashed vehicle, unleashing a stream of obscenities as he emerged. Others were appearing on the scene to lend help in forming a crowd, but Jude ignored their stares and headed across the street, Marlin at her side. She was determined to reach the body before anybody else. She wanted to see it before it was touched, wanted to meet its open eyes and fix its dead expression, know it, for memory's sake. She found his blood first, spattered in the grey slush underfoot, and then, a little way beyond, the assassin himself, reduced to a lumpen form in the gutter. As she came within a few yards of it, however, a shudder passed down its spine and it rolled over, showing its face to the sleet. Then, impossible though this seemed, given the blow it had been struck, the form started to haul itself to its feet. She saw how blooded it was, but she also saw that it was still essentially whole. "It's not human," she thought, as it stood upright. "Whatever it is, it's not human." Marlin groaned with revulsion behind her, and a woman on the pavement screamed. The man's gaze went to the screamer, wavered, then returned to Jude. It wasn't an assassin any longer, nor was it gentle. If it had a self, perhaps this was its face, split by wounds and doubt, pitiful, lost. She saw its mouth open and close as if it was attempting to address her. Then Marlin made a move to pursue it, and it ran. How, after such an accident, its limbs managed any speed at all was a miracle, but it was off at a pace that Marlin couldn't hope to match. He made a show of pursuit but gave up at the first intersection, returning to Jude breathless.
"Drugs," he said, clearly angered to have missed his chance at heroism. "Fuckers on drugs. He's not feeling any pain. Wait till he comes down. He'll drop dead. Fucker. How did he know you?"
"Did he?" she said,
her whole body trembling now as relief at her escape and terror at how close she'd come to losing her life both stung tears from her.
"He called you Judith," Marlin said.
In her mind's eye, she saw the assassin's mouth open and close, and on them read the syllables of her name.
"Drugs,"
Marlin was saying again, and she didn't waste words arguing, though she was certain he was wrong. The only drug in the assassin's system had been purpose, and that would not lay him low, tonight or any other. Chapter 4 1 11 days after he had taken Esterbrook to the encampment in Streatham, Chant realized he would soon be having a visitor. He lived alone and anonymously in a one-room flat on a soon-to-be-condemned estate close to the Elephant and Castle, an address he had given to nobody, not even his employer. Not that his pursuers would be distracted from finding him by such petty secrecy. Unlike Homo sapiens, the species his long-dead master, Sartori, had been wont to call the blossom on the simian tree, Chance kind could not hide themselves from Oblivion's agents by closing a door and drawing the blinds. They were like beacons to those that preyed on them. Men had it so much easier. The creatures that had made meat of them in earlier ages were zoo specimens now, brooding behind bars for the entertainment of the victorious ape.